log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
Trump on Saturday, December 5th, claimed a Democratic-led Senate will destroy the military through a lack of funding. But U.S. Congress last week passed a $740 billion Pentagon budget while Americans await economic relief, says Kenny Stancil Ryder in an article published under the heading Money for War. U.S. arms sales soar, and bipartisan militarism thrives amid COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States sold more than $175 billion in military equipment to foreign governments in the fiscal year that ended September 30. Pentagon and State Department officials announced recently a 2.8% increase compared to 2019, when weapons exports totaled just over $170 billion. The latest figures on arms transfers were released one day before President Donald Trump said that military offense is the most important thing a president can do during his mean, daring speech at the Republican Party Saturday night, December 6, on behalf of Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue of Georgia, who are facing Democratic candidates Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, respectively, in runoff elections next month that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Although he spent most of the evening repeating claims of voter fraud in November election and asserting that Democrats will cheat again, Trump on Saturday, December 5th, still encouraged rallygoers to support the two GOP lawmakers at the polls on January 5th to avenge his loss in the rigged presidential contest. At stake in this election is control of the U.S. Senate, and that really means control of this country, the president said. The voters of Georgia will determine which party runs every committee, writes every piece of legislation, controls every single taxpayer dollar. Trump's rationale for backing Loeffler and Perdue came in the form of a warning. If the radical Democrats get power, they will ram through the most extreme left-wing agenda ever conceived, while at the same time destroying the U.S. military through a lack of funding. Whereas Trump portrayed congressional Democrats as eager to pursue draconian military cuts, journalist Sarah Lazar argued last week that the annual approval of the gargantuan U.S. military budget, which she called one of the most reliable rituals in Congress, is so ordinary and overwhelmingly bipartisan, it's barely considered newsworthy. The U.S. has by far the biggest military budget on the planet, spending more than next 10 countries combined. Lazar continued, there is no indication that U.S. lawmakers plan to reverse this trend anytime soon. For six consecutive years, the military budget has either increased or stayed roughly the same, taking inflation into account. As the nation All Priorities Project pointed out in June, the military budget in 2019 accounted for 53% of the federal discretionary budget, while millions of the country's working-class households, battered by the COVID-19 pandemic and corresponding economic crisis, await a new relief package that ameliorates widespread hardship. Congress had no problem passing legislation to continue U.S. military violence, Lazar added. Lazar pointed out that the Senate version of the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, passed on July 23rd in a vote of 86-14, while the House version was approved on July 21st by a margin of 295-125. This NDAA was subsequently approved last week by both chambers of Congress. Lazar wrote that while it is entirely routine at this point, it's useful to highlight on the eve of yet another massive Pentagon handout how the budget for war could instead go toward life-preserving social goods. That we can find the money for war but not for coronavirus relief exposes the moral rut at the center of U.S. politics, a rut that must be dug out and expunged if we are to get through this crisis, she added.
Economic divide.
It is being hailed as the world's largest free trade deal in history. It encompasses 15 nations across the Asia-Pacific region, including Australia, China, Indonesia, Japan, and South Korea, which, incidentally, sees the five nations just mentioned also being members of the G20, making the new Asia-Pacific trade deal an exciting prospect for that bloc. Now, labeled as the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, the Mega Free Trade Pact came into place just recently, allowing the member nations to enjoy multiple advantages, including the reduction of tariffs, simplified customs agreements, and a reduction in trade costs, to name a few. Well, the agreement appears to have some common traits with other existing global trade deals. For example, in the case of the EU, with the free movement of people being a key aspect, which for some could see many people in member nations being given new opportunities, hence lifting them out of poverty.
information age, digitalization, they can learn from each other's experiences, and the people-to-people movement will be very freely movement like EU. So this kind of agreements always bring fruitful results for the local people, the poverty alleviation, the joining technology transfers.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kabatahwe. In this week's show, we'll be taking a deeper look into the signing of the RCEP and ascertain just how it may benefit various countries who have become members and examine just how big of an impact the RCEP will have on the global economy. Now, just as a point of note, following our exclusive story that was covered right here on Economic Divide surrounding the Air Canada scandal. So, just how big a deal is the RCEP? For starters, the negotiations over the agreement have taken 8 years, and now that it has been signed and sealed, the member nations of the RCEP account for one-third of the world's population, and more importantly, some 29% of the total world GDP, making the RCEP larger than the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement and the European Union. The impact of the RCEP is likely to have on the global economy, well, it is also a highlight of the fact with the Peterson Institute for International Economics stating that the deal could see an increase in global national income of around $186 billion. NC member states have their GDPs increased by at least 0.2%. The pact could have been a lot bigger. In fact, incorporating half the world's population. For example, in this case, we're referring to India. India with this 1.35 billion people and huge economy. Well, it was also part of that plan, yet India pulled out at the 11th hour as it felt that by signing the deal, it would see its own economy and industry suffer. However, the door has been left open for India to join at any time in the future.
The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or the RCEP, is the world's largest free trade deal and has taken 8 years to formulate. With 15 member nations, including five of which are in the G20, the partnership is set to allow member nations to trade together on a more fluid basis and hopefully allow the region to expand economically together. Traditionally, the Asian Pacific area has enjoyed similar trade deals in the past, but with multilateralism becoming an ever more popular concept around the world, in an attempt to break current hegemonies, the notion of global cooperation has some interesting advantages. Already, the European Union is an example of a successful regional trade pact, and there are numerous others around the world. So how then does the RCEP compare with such agreements? Are there any similarities, and are there any differences?
Yeah, obviously, there are some overlaps between this new agreement and other existing agreements, such as the Asian Free Trade and others. But as we understand, there are also some bigger differences between this new one and the existing ones. For example, there have been new countries who joined the agreement. In addition to Asian countries, we have New Zealand and Australia as new members. And this will bring together a bigger force to promote free regional trade.
With the introduction of new countries into the deal, with the likes of New Zealand and Australia now being part of the RCEP, there's now a very good opportunity to demonstrate that regional cooperation could be a perfect tool to promote development and trade. What now remains to be seen is whether the nations aligned to the RCEP can overcome political differences and concentrate on trade to bolster economies, all looking to emerge from the impact of the coronavirus that's done so much damage around the world.
How do the benefits of being a member of the RCEP convert into numbers? Well, for smaller nations, the impact is immediate, with the likes of Vietnam seeing their GDP rising anything between 2 and 4%, which for Vietnam is a significant increase, which will no doubt be emulated by other smaller economy members. The market scale of the RCEP is also interesting when put into numbers. As we have already mentioned, the deal results in about 29% of the world GDP, which is some $26.2 trillion US dollars, and equates to a sum of 32.5% of global investment. The advantages are also truly regional, as most of the trade between Asia-Pacific nations is conducted within the area. Examples of this are the $532.6 billion per year that Australia enjoys with the region, and for New Zealand, it accounts for 56% of the country's exports. providing 61% of the total foreign investment into the country, again, proving that the RCEP will be most fruitful.
There's no doubt that as the world's second largest economy and rising fast, China firmly has its eyes set on the top spot in the world, with many suggesting that China overtaking the US at the top of the economic ladder is not a case of if, but when. For some, the RCEP has been criticised as it will more than likely benefit China more than other signatory members. With China being the economic powerhouse behind the agreement, it seems that China in particular has a lot to gain by having 14 other free trade partners at its disposal. The economic expansion sought by China and demonstrated through the likes of the One Belt, One Road initiative are clear examples of how China is using trade to expand its footprint around the world. And as we deal with trade wars, COVID-19 and economic uncertainty, the RCEP is an example of China's multilateral adaptability to its economic roadmap.
Well, I think speaking of China, we need to think about, we need to put it against the general background of Chinese economic strategy. China has been promoting very hard its very ambitious One Belt and One Road project across the globe. And it comes at a very interesting time. We are now in the middle of a global pandemic. We are also seeing an escalating tension in China and the US and also some regional countries. So I think this is something that will be supplementing China's One Belt, One Road project.
However, not 1 month into the agreement, and already small economic skirmishes have started to occur, in particular between Australia and China, where China has imposed tariffs on Australian wine, as well as seeing diplomatic tension rise over the abuse of civilians by the Australian military in Afghanistan, something that China has highly condemned. On a wider scale, tension between the US and the Chinese has also led to a war of words and trade between Washington and Beijing. However, with the tide set to turn in the US with the election of Joe Biden as president, a new government in the White House may see Biden's multilateral form of diplomacy reach out to China and once again see ties restored, fixing the damage committed by Donald Trump.
I'm pleased to say that joining me in the studio today is Martin Lockett, professor of strategic management from Nottingham University Business School, China. Currently based in Ningbo, Professor Lockett has over 40 years' experience in Chinese culture, economy, management, and development, and has worked on multiple consultancy projects and education programs in China. Professor, many thanks for joining us here on Economic Divide.
It's very good to be with you.
So first up, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, a huge project, as you're well aware, and it has been labeled as the world's largest free trade agreement, 8 years in the making. How important do you think this deal is, and how will this spark the regional economy off in the post-pandemic era?
We are absolutely right that this is one of the world's largest free trade agreements, if not the largest. It's going to cover 15 countries with about 30% of the world's population and 30% of the world's economy. That includes China, Japan, South Korea, the 10 Asian countries, Australia and New Zealand. So it's going to make much of Asia Pacific into a free trade zone. It's going to be a bit like the European Union or the North America in that respect. So it's been estimated over time that it will have a very big impact. One from some professors at Johns Hopkins University in the US estimates a positive impact of $186 billion. In terms of global income. However, that's only really 0.2% of the world economy, so it's still limited in that respect.
Okay, well, you've got five members of the RCEP who are in the G20. How do you think the trade deal will benefit the larger economies in the region? For one, many are stating already that the big winner in this deal is China. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, clearly China's going to be a winner. It's going to help overall economic development in all the countries. So in that sense, you've got 15 winners. Actually, the losers are going to be probably the US and India. Now, that's not so much that they're going to get real damage to their economies from this, but they're going to lose opportunities. So one estimate about India was it might have a small economic damage from the impact of the free trade zone elsewhere, but it's going to lose opportunities compared with what if it took part. So from that viewpoint, it's the what we sometimes call opportunity costs that are the big ones for those who are not taking part, and benefits for all those taking part. If we look politically, then I think it can be seen as a demonstration of multilateralism in practice by China. And I think that's where possibly the biggest benefit to China lies, in its showing a commitment to multilateralism.
And finally, the legacy left by Donald Trump saw China and the U.S. fall into a bitter trade war. That may or may not improve under the new administration. Will then a deal as big as the RCEP spark a wider global battle as allies of the U.S. and the EU attempt to compete with such a deal? Or they slowly have to accept that multilateralism is the way forward and adapt accordingly?
Well, I think the EU and USA will accept this deal. I think it's likely that the new U.S. administration, led by the soon-to-be President Biden, will adopt a more multilateral approach and will look at how it can extend those agreements and maybe get back into some that it's left under President Trump. I mean, I think the U.S. could potentially seek to extend the RCEP to bring back its previous idea of something called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but that was essentially a rather wider agreement that also involved the US. So for now, I think we see three big trading blocks, the EU, the Americas, and RCEP, and then outside it, some countries like India and potentially the UK after Brexit.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks there to Professor Martin Lockett from Nottingham University Business School, China. Great hearing your thoughts and information. Many thanks for being with us on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, lots of interesting ideas there. Of course, we still have to wait for Joe Biden, the president-elect, to be confirmed. All right, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up after the break. We'll be joined by our regular researcher and journalist, Latifah Haidar. She runs us through some of the stories hitting social media pages surrounding the RCEP. Also look at how smaller economies will benefit or lose out from joining the RCEP, as well as taking a look at how other global trade agreements will react to the creation of the RCEP. Also a deeper look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus on the Asia-Pacific economy in our in-depth section. Time now for our in-depth section. Much like the rest of the world, the COVID-19 virus has had a heavy impact on the economies of the nations in the Asia-Pacific region. A report by Oxford Economics highlights this, that this region is going to be recovering the fastest once the pandemic subsides. Now, we move on to the next report, and our in-depth look comes from the World Bank, and what it states is that global GDPs will contract on average at a rate of 2.8% for 2020, growing to around 6% in 2021. Yet for China, well, that's going to benefit. 9% is what is going to rise in terms of GDP, in part assisted by the extra trade generated from the signing of the RCEP. And finally, when compared to the rest of the world, one of the main issues will be the time that it takes to recover. And much like an injury on a person, this depends on the depth of the scar. For example, looking here for the UK, it saw its economy fall by nearly 25% during the peak of the pandemic. South Korea, for example, a member of the RCEP, saw its economy shrink by only 7.6%, far lower than the global average of 12 to 14%. Let's now take a look at how smaller Asia-Pacific economies will benefit or not from the new RCEP deal in our next report.
We've already discussed the notion that China and other larger economies will benefit from the RCEP, but what then of the smaller economies in the pact? With the likes of Brunei, Vietnam, Thailand, and others in the agreement, as well as larger economies such as Malaysia, Indonesia, Australia, and New Zealand. The pot is well mixed in nations and economy sizes joining together, raising the question as to just what benefits the smaller nations may see from being a member of the RCEP.
From my understanding, I think there will be some impact, but in terms of positive impact, it may be very limited. Because if you look at the history of these countries trading with each other within the bloc, I think they have already enjoyed a very high level of free trade with each other. So with the new countries joining the club, we have if we're looking at China as the biggest player in the region, I'm not sure how these countries will be able to benefit.
So is the RCEP then just a rewording of existing agreements in place? And if so, how can smaller nations adapt a deal to suit their needs? The benefits of the RCEP will be bespoke to each member state. Yet for Vietnam, for example, figures suggest that the GDP of the country could rise by as much as 4%, which could play a significant part in the future economy of the nation.
We need to start this moment to reform our economy so that we can soon bounce back and assert our central position in world economy.
But lower down the scale, when it comes to the predictions of how the RCEP will benefit nations, is a much smaller growth rate. Although the RCEP area is huge when combined, some of the smaller nations could only see a 0.2% growth in their GDP, which makes one question the benefits of joining such a scheme. However, one must also acknowledge the notion of regional cooperation and solidarity. As to when it comes to trade, diplomacy and politics, there's no more important entity than one's own neighbours, and when push comes to shove, knowing they're there is a comforting feeling.
Time now to bring in researcher and journalist Adolphe Pallido to tell us more about the RCEP. Welcome. So tell us what you got for us for this, I guess, the biggest trading bloc in the world.
So let's see what I picked. The first one is from Peter Draper, and he is talking about a piece which talks about this trade pact is one small geoeconomic step or a giant eastward leap in a geostrategic gravity. This guy is obviously talking about with this trade pact, we're going to witness a shift of power from west to east. Something to think about. Let's go to the next tweet.
Sure, let's see what this one is.
This one, Dr. Rizwan is saying, RCEP will help recover members from pandemic losses at rapid pace. Well, this is one of the hopes that members of this pact are signing the agreement because of this, because China obviously is recovering faster than others, and it can help other members of the pact to recover more rapidly. Our final tweet is from someone who is against this trade pact. Harsh Shah says, it was foolish to enter into RCEP with non-market economy with so much state enterprises. China market economy stance is namesake, which one should not fall trap into. Well, this guy is obviously a pro-West and anti-China. They're saying that China is just entering into this agreement for the sake of China, and it's not going to help others.
Very well, thank you very much for that. We don't have much more to add to that. Thank you for that, Adolphe Pallido, researcher and journalist. Okay, in our final report, we're going to take a look at how the RCEP compares to other great trade deal giants, in particular, focusing on the EU and the US-Mexico-Canada agreement. So stay tuned.
It seems that the world has phased in and out of trade agreements from the moment the concept was invented. The likes of NAFTA was quashed by Donald Trump, which resulted in the birth of the US-Mexico-Canada deal, and the EEC was reborn into the EU in Europe, showing that flexibility and change are important parts of trade deals as they adapt to varying circumstances around the world. With the RCEP, it seems that the agreement, whilst on paper sounds very promising, could show signs of weaknesses like other pacts that have been and gone before them. Could then other trade agreements around the world emulate the examples set by the RCEP? And if so, just how?
I think in terms of the general direction of this agreement is something that this is something that the other parts of the world can probably learn from. But in terms of the actual impact, I think it still needs to be rigorously assessed to see how it actually bring positive impact to these member countries.
So why then do trade agreements collapse? In theory, the signing of a deal which can boost an economy should be a win-win situation for all parties concerned. Yet when we look back at trade agreements of the past, and even the ones that are still in play, one of the major challenges to maintaining an agreement is the political differences between nations. Take, for example, the case of the EU. The varying cultures and political views in Europe is as wide as the spectrum can allow, and is hence why the UK, for example, broke away from the EU. Yet, as we all know and have seen, the devastating economic cost of Britain appears to be far greater than the benefits of leaving the bloc over political differences. The same can be said of the NAFTA agreement, which saw Trump pull out of, citing a bad deal. This is another example of how differences in political thought have changed the shape of trade deals that were actually quite successful in the first place. For the RCEP, only time will tell whether it stands the test of time and political opinion. But from an optimistic point of view, the notion of multilateralism is a concept that should be embraced. And if the world starts to see super trade deals emerging, for example, between the EU and the RCEP, then the future may look very bright for the global economy and trade.
As the world emerges from one of the most devastating impacts to human life, as well as the economy, so too does it seem that the world is looking forward to a new political agenda. As the notion of multilateralism appears to be a common denominator, as countries bind together to create pockets of economic powerhouses around the world. With the EU, US, MIC, Canada, and now the RCEP, all being fine examples of how economies can work together towards a mutually beneficial system, the winds of change are starting to blow as the likes of China, South Korea, and Japan work their way up the economic ladder, threatening the position of the US and showing that the self-centered approach led by Donald Trump is a dated and ineffective way of building an economy. What now remains to be seen is whether the creation of the RCEP as a global competitor to the likes of the EU may spark in the future a super trade deal pact, merging together the likes of the RCEP and the EU, creating a multilateral pact never seen before. A lot remains to be done, but the future may just hold such a story. That's about all the time we have for this episode. On behalf of myself, Trevor Tapley, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe, and we'll see you again next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allahu Akbar!
Made in Germany. That's what many of those bombs dropping on Yemen read. In the ongoing Saudi-led war on Yemen, coalition forces rely heavily on German arms and technology. Germany prides itself on its restrictive export policies, which ban arms sales to countries involved in armed conflict. But recent reports show otherwise. In fact, according to an investigation by Germany's international broadcaster Deutsche Welle, the Saudi-led coalition uses German-built weapons and military tech. According to figures by German Economic Affairs Ministry, since early 2019, German arms manufacturers exported over $1.1 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and other countries involved in the war on Yemen as part of the Saudi-led alliance. Egypt also remains a major buyer of German military and naval equipment. The country recently purchased a frigate and submarine from Germany's ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. Egypt has dispatched warships to join the Saudi-led naval blockade of Yemen. Just last year in 2019, Germany's government approved arms exports worth over 800 million euros to Egypt. Germany is seemingly a part of an alliance of countries spearheaded by Saudi Arabia and includes the US, France, UK, UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, and Sudan, among others. Bahrain, Jordan, and Kuwait, which have all participated in airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition, are also customers of German arms manufacturers. Germany provides the coalition with battleships, combat jets, tanks, trucks, refueling aircrafts, and armored vehicles, according to Germany's international broadcaster, Deutsche Welle. These new revelations of Germany secretly selling arms to Yemen's enemies come after Berlin promised it would stop arms exports to countries involved in the ongoing war in Yemen. Following the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018, Germany adopted a moratorium on arms exports to Saudi Arabia that November. Back in January of 2018, Stefan Seybert, a spokesperson for German Chancellor Angela Merkel, said in a tweet that, to be more precise, the federal government is currently not making a decision on arms export licenses that is inconsistent with the exploratory results. Right after his tweet, Amnesty International tweeted, "Good news, Germany halts arms exports to parties to the conflict in Yemen. US, UK, France, and all other states selling arms to the Saudi-led coalition must halt arms sales now." But in December of that year, Germany ruled out laws to prevent circumventing Saudi arms export ban. The journalist was asking Maria Adaber, spokesperson for the Foreign Office at the time, to clarify, but apparently she just couldn't. Tania Alemany, spokesperson for the German Ministry of Economic Affairs, said that Germany had no control of companies with branches or business units in other countries. Apparently, that's exactly what happened. German companies took advantage of legal loopholes that were never closed from its 2018 ban on weapons export to those countries involved in the brutal war against Yemen. The figures from the German Economic Affairs Ministry show that armored all-terrain vehicles were exported to Saudi Arabia nonetheless. German companies, many of them tied to the German military, have a history of controversial weapons exports. In May of 2018, employees from the German arms manufacturer Heckler & Koch were charged with illegally exporting 15 shipments of weapons between 2006 and 2009, breaching both Germany's War Weapons Control Act and the Foreign Trade Act. The weapons, which included automatic assault rifles, ended up in especially violent parts of Mexico in the hands of drug cartels. On the streets of Germany, protests against the sale of weapons were the scene right before the global COVID-19 pandemic. In September of 2019, hundreds of anti-war activists rallied outside a munitions factory operated by the German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall in the Lower Saxon village of Unterlüss, calling on the corporation to disarm. Rheinmetall is headquartered in Düsseldorf, Germany. It was founded in 1889 and is a publicly traded company. Just in 2019, it earned 6.25 billion euros in revenues from its weapon sales. With or without loopholes, companies are still being allowed to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia via an official approval from the German government. The German government approved two arms sales to Saudi Arabia in the first 6 months of 2019, worth a total of $915,817, according to the Germany Economic Ministry. In the equivalent period of 2018, Saudi Arabia was Germany's third biggest customer, after Algeria and the United States, mainly buying naval boats. Chancellor Angela Merkel's administration approved five arms sales to Saudi Arabia from January to June 2018, worth a total of $200 million. In 2018, Saudi Arabia was Germany's top weapons importers. But in 2019, Saudi Arabia disappeared from the top list of importers of German weapons, and instead, Egypt, which is also a part of the coalition, took its spot. Observers say Egypt was replaced by Saudi Arabia. It most likely uses Saudi funds to purchase the weapons and then siphons them off to Saudi Arabia, or it uses them itself against Yemen. Germany had to do something about this, apparently, so it totally banned exports of Saudi Arabia in November. Saudi Arabia admitted that the decision made no difference anyways, as it has other sources of weapons. Of course, this is not the first ban on Saudi Arabia's purchasing of German weapons by Berlin. It is the third time since 2018. In 2019, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said that his country will extend its ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia because of the conflict in Yemen. More than 100,000 people have been killed in the war on Yemen, according to armed conflict location and event data. According to the UN's World Food Programme, 24 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance, while 20 million are food insecure. The UN calls it the worst humanitarian disaster on Earth, and yet, Germany and its Western partners, who preach human rights day and night, are fueling the war by their silence and, worst off, selling weapons to the same culprits in a war the Saudi-led coalition can't win.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
But obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes. With more and more allegations coming to light of crimes being committed during conflict, from the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by the US and British, to the recent allegations that Australian Special Forces were involved in the killing of innocent civilians in order to pass initiation tests, it just goes to show how deep the problem really lies. Currently, the World War Crimes Court is also heavily involved in the investigation of US crimes committed during conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet could the investigation into such crimes be suddenly dropped by the ICC should the US military refuse to cooperate? There does, however, lie a problem in the authority of the ICC, namely that the US has stated that it just does not recognise the court, with the US President Donald Trump stating that the ICC has no jurisdiction over them, something that's been echoed by the Israeli regime, who, much like the US, UK and Australia, are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yet with the UK failing to assist the ICC in its investigation, nor having even brought one single prosecution against any of its personnel, how then can the ICC execute justice with no parties interested in cooperating with them or even acknowledging its authority?
Well, it isn't really. By the way, I think that the British have actually prosecuted the military for various crimes over the years. Not enough of them. I mean, they've committed many of them over the centuries, you know, whether it was in India or Kenya or, you know, even more recently. But they have prosecuted some. In Northern Ireland, they were prosecuting people. But in this case, they've investigated and they've... Look, I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but from their point of view, they could say that they didn't have enough evidence to meet the burden of a prosecution.
Should the ICC continue to be ignored or see its authority blanked, the question that remains to be asked is whether the body has lost all credibility, and if so, how can the rest of the international community allow the US and its allies to undermine such international bodies as and when it suits them?
Large gaps, a looming deadline, and still no appetite for any compromise. The European Union and Britain are digging their heels in, sending jitters throughout Europe. Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson arrived in Brussels on Wednesday and sat down for tense talks with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen 3 weeks before the Brexit transition period ends. The two failed to break the logjams in the talks. The only thing the two sides agreed on was perhaps to continue the talks at least through Sunday. The negotiations are tough and stressful because so much is at stake. UK and EU positions remain far apart over access to fishing waters, rules about stabilizing businesses, and how any new deal will be enforced and policed.
Britain controls a tremendous amount of sovereign territory in the sea, and that was basically ceded to Brussels to decide what's done with that back in 1973. So that, I think, is going to be the big sticking point. You know, the traditionally large area of sea around Britain, including out into the Atlantic, which Britain has controlled, has been extremely bountiful, particularly for the French fishermen who've been fishing those seas. And so I think possibly the fishing rights are going to be the biggest sticking point.
The UK Premier admitted after his talks in Brussels that there was, quote, a strong possibility that Britain and the EU would fail to hammer out a free trade agreement at the end of the year. The disappointing outcome of the talks in Brussels triggered the EU to publish contingency plans for the split in trading ties. Observers believe the publication of the EU contingency plans at this point shows that the Europeans are seriously preparing for a possible no-deal Brexit. The European bloc says it intends to avoid immediate chaos at the beginning of January.
The the publication of contingency plans by Brussels is actually quite useful, but you know, this is the sort of thing that should have been published, I think, years ago, so it was laid out clearly for the public and for businesses, the sort of thing that may happen if there was no deal.
Long-running negotiations on a trade deal with Britain seem to be reaching a make-or-break moment. But the EU member states insist that despite the looming deadline, they will not be forced into a bad deal. Some European leaders have been loud in rejecting any unsatisfactory agreement. French President Emmanuel Macron has been particularly outspoken. He has insisted that UK firms can expect preferential access to Europe's single market only if they obey its rules. France is worried that the British side is pushing for a deal that could give UK companies an unfair competitive advantage in the European market. The French government has warned that France could veto a bad deal, accusing London of seeking to divide the EU to get better terms. France's demands and concerns are widely shared by other EU member states. European diplomats say all countries in the European Union are serious about defending their collective interests.
The European Union and Brussels do not want to give Britain a deal which any other state in the EU will look at and think that's something we could do with and we would like. So on that level, they want to give Britain a bad deal.
Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has shown little sign of flexibility. Is he bluffing, or does he really believe the UK can easily weather the storm even if it leaves the bloc without a deal? An economically damaging divorce would undoubtedly hurt both sides. But observers warn that the UK would be impacted much more severely than the EU in case of a no-deal departure.
It's one of the world's worst-kept secrets, but evidence pointing to the involvement of the Saudi regime into the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi has been kept hidden from the public domain based on intelligence service requests. However, for the first time since the assassination of the journalist in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, a US judge has ordered the partial disclosure of any evidence held by the US intelligence agencies to be delivered to a New York court within a fortnight. It's most likely that the judge in question, Paul Engelmeyer, is referring to a list of exhibits linked to the murder, and in particular to a tape recording of the incident in which the sound of Khashoggi and the perpetrators of the crime can be heard. Already, the CIA have concluded that the murder was approved by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, although not actually present at the time of the killing, but was more than likely the one who ordered and oversaw the operation taking place.
What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged and therefore is requiring further investigation, in particular of the Crown Prince, for a variety of reasons. The first one is that the people directly implicated in the murder reported to him. So there is a reporting line here that needs to be further investigated.
With the court taking such a step, it could be the first phase in ousting those truly responsible for the murder, and more importantly, removing a cloak of immunity that Bin Salman, for one, is happy to hide behind, hence finally demanding some notion of accountability.
It's a state killing, and as such, it is important that the state of Saudi Arabia be held accountable. So far, there has been no move on the part of the international community to treat the execution of Mr. Khashoggi as something that was sponsored, incited, ordered by the state.
What now remains to be seen is whether the likes of the CIA and other agencies in the US will obey the court order, or will they too hide behind the veil of national security interests in order to protect the likes of Bin Salman from finally being brought to justice. It seems that the young and inexperienced Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has allowed the power to go to his head, already forging a negative reputation for himself, as demonstrated in his range of recklessly backed actions since taking the position of Crown Prince. Yet could his actions now be coming back to haunt him? With the order by the US court to expose the tapes surrounding the murder, could the heavily cash-influenced and petrodollar relationship between the US and the Saudi regime be turning sour?
Bin Salman's also been accused of sending a murder hit squad to Canada to assassinate former Saudi intelligence official Saad al-Jabri, something that Bin Salman strongly denies. Yet all the evidence points towards the favoured modus operandi of the Crown Prince following the foiling of the plot by the Canadian security services. There's also speculation that Bin Salman met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a secret meeting just prior to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. However, the meeting has been denied, yet somehow suggests that Bin Salman was aware and briefed about the Israeli regime plot to murder on Iranian soil. But there's a saving grace for Bin Salman, namely the protection he enjoys from the current US President, Donald Trump. Following the murder of Khashoggi, Trump was happy to turn a blind eye to the event, likely dazed by the wads of cash flowing in from Saudi Arabia to the US through arms deals and more.
We also have a great ally in Saudi Arabia. They give us a lot of jobs, they give us a lot of business, a lot of economic development.
What now remains to be seen is whether the president-elect, Joe Biden, will be as accommodating towards Bin Salman as his predecessor. And if not, will Bin Salman survive without Uncle Donald by his side? March the 15th, 2019, saw one of the world's bloodiest massacres in modern history when Brenton Tarrant, a white supremacist, walked into Christchurch Mosque and opened fire on worshippers armed with automatic weapons that left many dead and a society deeply scarred. Following an extensive inquiry by the New Zealand authorities, the final report has suggested that there was a series of failures ahead of the incident that, although may not have prevented the attack, has certainly left many lessons to be learned for the future. It left the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, apologising for the failings and claiming that measures will be taken to prevent such acts in the future. One of the main findings, and something that's no doubt valid for countries across the globe, is the institutional racism that occurred prior to the attack, as well as an unconscious bias which is embedded into Western security and police services. Yet in spite of multiple warnings by the Muslim community in New Zealand regarding a rise in hate crime, it appears that nothing was done. So why then were the allegations being made, not taken seriously by those that should have? Yet the sad truth is that it's not just New Zealand that's seeing a rise in hatred against Muslims, as Islamophobia is on the rise across the world, with cases clear in Europe, the US, France, India, and beyond.
Islamophobia, this crime, this hate crime, should be defined very precisely and should be adopted as a law in every country, because it's distorted and they don't know what is Islamophobia, and people are swinging right and left and hitting the Muslims, in media and everywhere, and they're getting away with it. And it's the hatred against Muslims is growing in a lot of places. And the Muslims are becoming, a lot of them, not all of them obviously, are becoming immune to these attacks. It's become a normality because they're trying to adopt these Western governments and Western societies. And they're overlooking some of them, these issues. But these issues, they accumulate and they start to grow problems. And eventually we see the results as the New Zealand Christchurch attack or the attack in Quebec.
One only has to look at the latest action movies and video games hitting the screens to see that racism is rife across the world, in particular when it comes to anti-Islamic sentiments, with the stereotypical bad guy being cast as a Muslim extremist. Furthermore, anti-Islamic feelings have been demonstrated in France with the publication of offensive cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad, which, having been published in magazines, shows another medium in which Islamophobia exists. Yet it's how different leaders are dealing with the issue that truly dictates how a nation will come together to fight.